think we came to the conclusions that we wanted to in order to set for ourselves the pathway to ask a particular set of questions and answer those questions scientifically. The questions that we wanted to answer were basically, we talked about what was going to make what we wanted, and we talked about happiness and immortality, basically. And we did some comparison to say, does Christianity at least claim to deliver that for you? And we said, we made some arguments for yes. And so if these are the things we're looking for, and we determined that this is basically the ethic of love, which is central to Christianity. And everybody of course knows that one can love and therefore probably be happy in this life and be loved and be happy in this life without Christianity. What does Christianity give you? What two things does it give you that just regarding other people with this highest ethic of love can't? As would anybody remember? I did a bad job teaching. Love alone will not make you immortal. So we know that if we really, really do want to live forever, Christianity is a religion that promises immortality, and you have to evaluate it, and we have over the last couple of years, on its truth claims. So ultimately, it's not love plus Christianity. It's basically Christianity, a sub-portion of which says, the major theme of which is, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. So this is love God and man. And so we had said, yes, this is, if doing this right here is most likely to bring us what it is that we want in the long run. This is the surest path to happiness and immortality is basically Christianity. And Christianity claims that the right path to doing this is loving God and loving man. And we made some arguments last time of why loving God might even be sufficient, not only in the next life kind of idea, but also even in this life, for those that are so equipped. But the question we wanted to ask was, all right, fine, that's nice to wave one's hands and say, the secret to life is learning to love everybody and loving God. Great, how do we do that? Because, what did we say the number one problem was, at least for us? If we say, this is correct, but I don't necessarily desire this. I don't necessarily wake up in the morning and the first thing that hits my head isn't, I'm hungry. First thing that hits my head isn't, I got to go to work. The first thing that hits my head isn't, check Facebook. And the first thing that hits my head is not always, I just feel driven and compelled to love God and love my neighbor. How can I do that the first thing this morning? So it seems like we have a desire problem. Our desires are not lined up with what we say will make us the happiest. So that was one of the things that we pointed out over the course of the last few weeks was we have a little bit of a mental problem. We claim we want one thing, but we desire another set of things. So how do we, the question we really wanted to ask was, how do we change desire? And by desire, what I mean is, how do we change what we seem to want on autopilot versus what we say we want if we're asked in almost an academic environment? Does that part make sense? If that doesn't resonate with you, raise your hand and I'll try to express it in a different way. But that seems to be my problem is, and many people's problem. Look, I'd like to have a nice, stable financial future, but whenever X goes on sale, I feel like I just have to have it. It's that short-term, long-term, it's that immediate desire, long-term desire. It's the, I think that this is what I want, but I act like that is what I want type of behavior that we're trying to figure out. So how do we change desire? Now, we said there were two things that contribute to our desires. We said you have to know the choices. You'll remember I told a story about the factory in Central America. If they didn't know, they didn't want. We have to know the choices, and the culture in which you live actually tells you a lot of what it is that you desire. We desire high-heeled shoes because the culture tells us high-heeled shoes are something to be desired. We desire ties or suits because the culture tells you that's what you're supposed to wear at work. We desire a certain type of car, even though it might be impractical or difficult to drive. Anybody ever driven like a true sports car, Ferrari, Lamborghini, even for fun or anything like that? They're terribly, terribly difficult to drive, and uncomfortable, insanely uncomfortable. But we drive them for a whole bunch of different reasons. I mean, honestly, some of the cheapest cars out there are the most comfortable and easy to maintain and all that kind of stuff. It's just, they're not as cool. So where's cool somehow, by the way, has to fit into all of this. If you haven't heard Alistair McGrath talk about, I'll imitate this one, I won't do it rightly, but he talks about Clint Eastwood back in the heyday when he was making, was at his most famous, he was at his apex. And somebody asked him, they're like, Mr. Eastwood, you seem to be a really cool guy. Why is it people say you're cool? And he leaned back in his chair pensively, flipped out a cigarette from the cigarette case, caught it in his lip, picked up his boot, struck his match, sucked in the cigarette and said, I don't know.
So I think it's because he drives a Gran Torino.
Because he drives a Gran Torino. You kids get off my lawn. So we know that this seems to contribute to things that we laugh at. But in fact, we desire. It's strange. We think they're silly when we identify them. Isn't it silly that we want this, that we want high-heeled shoes, that we want ties, that we want cars that are impractical to drive? Yeah, it is kind of silly. Don't you still want it? Yeah, I still want it. It just doesn't make sense. Why it doesn't make sense, and this isn't conspiracy theory stuff. This I'm not staying in the bounds, sorry. This isn't conspiracy theory. This is scientific. And when you hear the term brainwashing, that's an old term from basically the 60s and 70s. People were trying to figure out whether you could take something that somebody believes is true and change them, cleanse them of that belief, and turn that belief into something else. So even though the term brainwashing now kind of has a lot of certainly negative connotation, the political re-education camps in former areas in which Vietnam War occurred, or some of the ones that this kind of idea is famous, where they have political re-education. China does this, political re-education camps used to do it a lot more. So the question was, does it work? And the answer is, yeah, it does work. Propaganda works, and political re-education works as well. It doesn't work all the time, and you hear great stories of people who resist, and either die resisting or escape and that kind of stuff, or they make it out of the camp and fake their way through it. But at the end of the day, people do it, not because they just want to, but because it does work. So, and I'm not saying that the culture intentionally brainwashes us, right? I don't think that there is a group, a cabal of six guys or gals, or what's the council in the Avengers called? World Security Council, I think. There's no World Security Council setting the agenda for the whole world, in my estimation. Not in flesh and blood, anyway. I don't say that there's some grand conspiracy there, but what I am saying is that this all kind of feeds on itself. And eventually, the culture kind of tells you what it is that you ought to desire, and it kind of tells you what it is you ought to fear. And if you don't think the fear thing is true, run the statistics. You know, how many right now? What's the leading news? What's the number one thing we're supposed to be afraid of in America?
Guns.
Okay, that's one. All right, that's one of one. And who wielding the guns, maybe particularly?
Terrorists.
And who's the terrorist du jour?
ISIS,
right. So ISIS is the major threat right here.
I thought you were going to say Trump.
Don't give me the conspiracy theory thing. Man. Who knows how that all links together. Right, so ISIS is something to be feared. Now, Al-Qaeda was something to be feared before as well. How many Americans did Al-Qaeda kill? 3,000-ish, right? Depending on whose numbers, it could have been. It was 20,000, I remember, when it first got reported. It got pulled down to 10, eventually down to 3-ish. The 3,000 Americans, how many Americans die in automobile accidents every year?
A lot more than that.
I mean, Americans die because of a diet that's high in fat and sugar and all that kind of stuff, as I drink espresso laden with whole milk and sugar. If we were being completely scientific, the list of the things that we fear, men is going to start with heart disease. Ladies probably, I think, starts with cancer. I'm not 100% sure on that one. But the bottom line is the things that we ought to fear, the probability that you will be killed by, fill in the blank, the things that we run on the national news don't even break into the top 10, ever. So, and you may say, well, you can do something about terrorists, but you can't do something about heart disease. Is that true? No, we know that's not true either. So what we really want to do is let's be smart, let's be scientific, let's use the best tools of knowledge discovery that we possibly can in order to live our lives in the smartest possible way. That's a worthy goal. And if that smartest possible way ought to be geared at getting what it is that we all say we want the most at the end. So that's what we've said over the last few classes. Now what we said we're going to do this time is figure out how to do this, how to change desire, and how to do so in a way that leads us directly back here. So, what are these two? One, is there anything else that we're missing right here? Is there anything else that you want to add to this that says, I think something else is a candidate for how to change desire?
Understanding the either the laws or the philosophy of consequence.
Okay.
Consequences.
And
experience.
Yes. And so I'm going to put knowledge. Yes.
Experience, because as you labor through life, you learn, and God works in your life, and you learn lessons.
Exactly.
And that
nobody
changes
does,
your desires.
Nobody does everything right.
So for that reason, let me actually kind of convert this thing into knowledge. And maybe even, so yes, both of those experience gives you knowledge. It gives you good, true knowledge, hopefully. Sometimes it teaches you bad stuff, false stuff, but true knowledge. And this, I think this point also runs to knowledge. It's learning to know kind of the right thing. So I think knowledge can be key. And then knowledge also is going to imply, in the way that I'm using it here, maybe knowledge management. Knowledge management. Because one can know a million things. And isn't your major objection... My major objection to school, everybody said this in school, was when you're in a class, you're having to learn something, it's very abstract or it's very tedious, what's the question, what's the thing you always said in high school or junior high or college? When am I ever going to possibly use this? And what we mean is, what possible benefit does this knowledge have to my goals of living my life and being happy? And sometimes that's a good question and sometimes we're wrong about it. But ultimately, figuring out what to know and pursuing that knowledge is important.
I'm confused as to the goal here. Are you trying to say that you have to love God and your neighbor and everybody else 24 hours a day and give up the high heels, the ties, the Lamborghini? I'm confused as to what the ultimate goal is.
This is the ultimate goal.
Does that mean then 24 hours a day of loving God and loving your neighbor and giving up all the rest of the stuff?
That's what we're in the process of figuring out. So great question. So another, if you didn't hear what Dennis was saying, Dennis's question was, is the goal just loving God and loving your neighbor 24/7? That's what our goal is? No. Our goal is this. The question is loving your neighbor and God 24/7 and giving up all these other things the surest way to that? And what we're saying is that's something we're still gonna look at. So we're gonna find out what the answer is to that. So knowledge, I agree. In fact, I think you're right, we should broaden it to knowledge and maybe even what knowledge is important. So what knowledge would you say is knowledge that we want?
Well, we would definitely want to know that if we do something, what our net result is going to be if we act on something that is presented to us.
Okay.
That goes back to a choice, which we could take all the way back to the Garden of Eden if you want to.
So knowing what we act like cause and effect is a normal thing. How does cause and effect work? All right, and that's almost kind of like the basic workings of the universe, or beyond. So, yes, and let me hold on to that one for a little bit. Don't forget to look back at this chain, by the way. The reason that people mess this up, the reason we in this room mess this up, is we start to fixate, we get here knowledge, and we automatically ask the question, what are the kinds of things I want to know? That's not the right question to ask. The right question to ask is, what do I need to know to do this, to get this? Because anything else other than pursuing this is pursuing something that is not this. Now, what's not happiness? Unhappiness. What's not immortality? Death. Now, this isn't some crazy religious thing, right? This is simple logic. You're either pursuing happiness and immortality, or you're pursuing something other than happiness and immortality. And something other than the happiness and immortality is sadness and death. So let's not do sadness and death. Let's do happiness and immortality. Fair assumption, right? So if we're doing that, what do you have to know? Well, we already talked about this. We made an argument for a couple times ago, so we're kind of using it as an assumption at this point. But basically, what we're saying is Christianity has to have been, in order for this chain to hold, it must be the case that Christianity is true and that its dictates and promises and implications are true as well. And if it is, and this is what it says, then this is the question that we ask, and these are the things that we need to know in order to answer this question. So, I ask again, what do we want, what do we need to know? If you want to love your wife, what do you need to know? Oh, come on, guys.
I got a place to start.
You need to know your wife, right? Yes, sir. Go ahead.
So, I like to do things, whatever. I do things.
Yes.
And a lot of times, most of the time, it involves people. One thing I've learned about love, yes, I love people. Arbitrarily, across the board, there's nobody I don't like.
I'll introduce you to some people I know.
But what I've learned from knowledge and love is, yes, I can still love people, but if I want to do something for them, whatever it is, I do not expect to get anything in return. And that leads me to more happiness than if I do expect to get something.
This attitude, to me, is part of the essence of love. Love is something that is selfless and benevolent for and thinks of only the other person. Selfless implies that. So if you're loving, if you're doing something good for somebody else because you're going to get something back, that may be benevolent, but it's not selfless. So it's not the truest essence of love. It might be loving, but it's not pure love. And I'm not saying pure love has to be detrimental to you. It's just that wouldn't be part of your consideration, was whether it did you any good. My belief is that true love actually is reciprocal and ends up building good regard for yourself. But to know, who do we have to love? If we're going to love somebody, remember, we're saying that the key to this is this. If the key to this actually is this, then who are the objects of this? Then who do we need to know? One thing we need to know, we need to have knowledge of God. If you're going to love God, you have to know Him well, in the same way that if you're going to love your husband or your wife, you have to know Him well. Now, what I mean by that is, isn't that you can't love a complete stranger. Of course you can love a complete stranger. But here's an easy example that you see all the time. Which is better, ladies, this is principally directed to you. Which is better, and it does depend on your attitude maybe. This might backfire on me. Which is better, your husband goes to Jared's Jewelry and buys you a random piece of jewelry. When I say random, I mean it's not something that you said that you wanted. It's not something that you secretly desired. It's literally like you had gone through and put your finger on something random in there. That, at $3,000 worth of jewelry. Or he heard you mention 2 years ago how the thing that you loved most in your childhood, the thing that you yearned for, was every Christmas you got one of those little Lifesavers packs that's very hard to find now. It's in a cardboard case kind of thing. And one time you got a little white furry kitten, doll, toy, whatever, and it was because of the sacrifice your parents had to make in order to give that to you, it had particular meaning for you. And he went out and found the original version of those two things and gave those to you for Christmas. Which of those two indicates love more to you? The second one? Yeah, second one. Why? The value of the first is clearly greater. And if you wanted, you could go sell that at a tenth of its price for $300 and buy 15 kittens and 200 Lifesavers packs. So it makes no sense, doesn't it, on a monetary value.
The value is not greater to you.
Right. Say it again.
The value isn't greater to you.
Because? Why is the value different to you? Absolutely right. Because money isn't something that we value. Financial value, trade, the ability to get things, isn't what you value. What the value was there was another soul heard you say something that was important to you. There was something that you feel was part of your identity. It is part of your desire. And that soul heard you and pursued that good for you. That's why you like it. And you have to know the person in order to do that. You don't have to know a lot about them. That could be a one word overhearing thing. But you got to know them a little bit. The better you know someone, the more equipped you are to be good to them and to love them. Dennis, you had a question.
I was just going to say, if I came home with a $3,000 diamond from Jared's, well, I could say chump change.
Yep. Take it back. It's unreal. but it won't make her happy. Okay, so you got to know God, and you got to know others. Other people, we'll just say others. The best way to know somebody, to love somebody, is based in your knowledge of them and in your regard for them. Knowledge of God is difficult. Why? Obvious. You make an appointment with him in the conference room here. He doesn't seem to show up. You know, you ask questions. He doesn't seem to answer. We don't seem to be able to interact with him. How about this? My wife and I got engaged. Let me make sure I count these rightly. I probably won't remember.
You better get it right.
We got engaged after, I think, seeing each other, you know, maybe 8 dates, maybe seeing each other 4 separate times over the course of 2 years. We lived in different countries. I lived in Japan, she lived in Okinawa, and she lived in Hawaii and Oregon at the time. We got engaged without ever having lived in the same city, without ever having lived in the same country, without ever having spent more, I would say the aggregate amount of time we spent together might have been 3 weeks. We got engaged based on that. And we got married after I moved to Portland, and I was in Portland for like a week. So total time that these two knuckleheads spent together was certainly less than 2 months, probably less than a month, of actual I'm sitting there in front of you time. How did we interact most of the time? Phone calls. And letters. This was back, I mean, there was email, but we actually wrote the hand letter type of thing. We got to know each other from the letters that we wrote to each other in a very one way. And if you go back and you read those letters, you can know those two people pretty well from what you read in those letters. So when people complain that God doesn't sit there and talk directly to me, my first question is, have you read his book? How well do you know the author? Now, I don't mean that a little flippantly, because obviously he didn't write it himself. It was the whole doctrine of inspiration type of thing. But the idea is, if these are God's ideas, where are the two places we can find them? We can find God's ideas directly revealed in Scripture. Where's the other place we can find God's ideas?
Everywhere you look.
Everywhere you look. The world itself, the scientific world, is, if God does exist and he did create it, says something key about him in the same way that every part of a painting says something important about the artist that painted it. A true artist, I mean, I'm talking the kinds that cut their ears off and mail them to people, they will, if you walked up to them and said something like this, I've seen one of your paintings, I know you and I understand you. That other artist would say, you're probably right, you know, let me hear what you got from that, and yes, you do know me. That can be done. Most of that, 90% of that's probably pretension nowadays. But at the end of the day, the artist pours his own life in there. And how many authors, when you say, where did you get this character? Ultimately, you're like, well, actually, I know a guy very similar to that. You know, I just changed his name and a few details of it. But the bottom line is, a lot of the characters that we write into our own stories are experiences from our own life. So you can know somebody very, very well by the art they produce. This world is God's art, if that is the case. This world says something about it. So scientific pursuit teaches you stuff about God and that you would not otherwise know. And scriptural pursuit teaches you stuff about God that you would not probably be able to discern as clearly from the natural world. So those are two important places to look. And then knowing others, we'll kind of skip that for now, because I think we all know how to know other people. But a lot of it is not doing the old joke, which is the fighter pilot joke you may have heard of. The guy goes on, fighter pilot goes on a date, and an hour into the date, he's like, you know what, I'm tired of talking about me. Why don't you talk about me for a while? So if you want to know somebody, you have to listen. You have to ask them questions, you have to listen. All those kind of basic things. But
that's
funny. Lots of fighter pilot jokes out there. Skyler probably got a few of them too, yeah. By the way, a quick aside, if you have not read Skyler's Star Wars As Told by a Padawan, where Creep and Kid A are narrating. He stops the film. Did you do it at the end, or did you stop it through?
Went through it once and watched the whole thing, and then went through it again and kind of stopped it.
And gets their feedback on it. It is one of the best pieces of modern literature ever written for anybody that kind of knows the Star Wars stuff and has some affinity for that. It is worth a read. It's terrific.
How can I get it?
I'll send you a link.
Send the link, I will post it on Facebook. But very great and interesting, right? And Han did shoot first. Everybody should know. Okay, so if we know we need to have knowledge of God and others, let's just leave that right there for now. Let's leave this right here for now. But do we agree that at least makes sense? If you're going to love somebody, you got to know them. What about this problem right here? And we alluded to it last time, what are the extreme examples of, I want to rid myself of desires that the culture gives me that I would say in an academic environment are silly. What's one way to do that? Monasticism, becoming an Amish or Mennonite community member, that kind of thing. How do we say we do it in Protestant Christianity?
Well,
What's the way that you're kind of supposed to do this? This is the in the world and not of the world. And if you haven't heard this model used in church kind of stuff, it's usually a Sunday school kind of taught thing, but ultimately, the idea is we come together on Sundays as a church to, we can be completely open. There should be no guard up. There should be no evil here. This is the place for refreshment and rejuvenation, etc. And then from Sundays together time, that gives you the being not in the world time. That's the culture with which you would identify. And that's who you would say you are. I am most myself when I am among my Christian brothers and sisters. That's supposed to be the idea. And then when you go out in the world, you are in enemy territory, so to speak. You may have heard it outlined that way. But we, most of the time we don't feel that way, do we? In fact, the line between your social interactions at church and your social interactions in the world might be completely undifferentiable. And this is one thing that I think is a problem with modern Christianity today. Now, Tony Pedroni is trying to fix that here in what in this church's model. They have declared three goals, which are good ones, and you can read them for yourself. But ultimately, shepherd groups are supposed to be that protective set of, this is where my true identity is, and then from here, I pray about things, I figure out how to do things, and I go from there to interact with the world type of idea. So that's the authentic Christian community. Community is supposed to be, is where your culture comes from. Now, is that the case? Can your culture come from a sub-community smaller than the U.S. community? Absolutely. Give me some examples.
Teenagers,
a specific set of teenagers, pick one. I like goth as a great example, because most people look at goth kids and they're like, that's weird. Everybody's wearing mascara, even the boys. I don't get it. The hair colors. If you haven't seen Goth Dancing to Thomas the Train Tank Engine, that's a great one too. The goth looks from the outside like they are completely outside of our culture. They're anti our culture. But when you step within this goth circle, it is a small culture. It's a small culture that they feel is their identity, and they can feel the most comfortable. They can interact honestly with each other. Nobody's going to make fun of them. Nobody's going to call them an idiot or a loser or whatever it is that was the reason they went to be a part of this subculture. Now, hopefully that's not the reason that you became a Christian, was you're just tired of people, you know, calling you an idiot and a loser, and so you went to a place where people held their arms open and said, this is a good place to be. But if that was the reason, what does it mean the Christians are doing? Absolutely doing the right thing. Do you want to know, in my opinion, why the ranks of the gay community swell like they do? I can tell you a young man in our Christian, evangelical Christian school who was a little bit effeminate and would have told you, or I assume he was telling the truth, that he was not gay. But we, and I'll put myself in that, I've never made fun of him, but I didn't go beating anybody up that did. We made fun of him to such a degree that he felt like an outsider who welcomed him with open arms. Brother, you're one of us. All right, so this works both ways, and you got to be careful about how you treat other people. And I'm not saying that's why all people become gay. That's not the case. But what I'm saying is the Christian community was not loving in that way, and they pushed a guy out into another community. And that community swapping thing happens all the time, because one community, the person doesn't feel comfortable in that community. So culture can be a sub-major culture thing. And this is one of the ideas. So this culture kind of thing basically becomes a, where are you, you? It's a strange way of asking the question, but where do you, you know, if you ask a goth guy, who are you? He would say, I'm a gothic person. If you ask a person of the gay community, who are you? They will tell you part of their identity, I'm gay. Many of them will, not all of them, but many of them will. If you go to a triathlete community, you know, the extreme athlete kind of community, hey, what do you do? Who are you? Well, I'm a triathlete. Really? That's your major identity, is that you run, bike, and swim? My kids run, bike, and swim. Are they triathletes? I'm like, you're only triathletes. I can play like 10 sports. I'm a deca-athlete. Because they can run me into the dirt. Yeah, CrossFit. If you don't think CrossFit is a completely separate subculture, You haven't been to a CrossFit workout. All right, so this, I think, is helpful in answering the questions, how do we change desires? One is this. You're going to have to pursue knowledge actively. Actively pursue knowledge, and a particular type of knowledge. To underscore this one, if you want to be an astrophysicist, and you want, and the people you want to interact with, you had better know something about astrophysics. And you probably better know something about their work. So that's a good way to know and love astrophysicists. If you want to get engaged to a girl, you better actively pursue knowledge about that girl. If you want to join the military will take care of actively pursuing knowledge. All you have to do is show up and say, I am here to be educated, they say. We will do that for you. Please turn in everything, including your underwear. We will reissue you everything that you have. Actively pursuing knowledge is something that we do already. This is not, I'm not asking you to do something hard. I'm asking you to do something you do already. What knowledge do you actively pursue automatically?
Food.
Knowledge of food? I wish more people sought active knowledge of food, because then our food would be better. But yes, we actively seek the food, yes. But what knowledge do we quickly pursue? Automatically. What's the first thing you do when you get up?
Make coffee.
Then what? For the older generation,
shower, shave.
I'm putting myself in there. How much of the morning routine is coffee and the paper? Nowadays, it's coffee and CNN.com or FoxNews.com or MSNBC.com. Or it's Facebook, because Facebook will bring you the knowledge. You don't even have to worry about seeking. It will bring it to you via your friends' ideas of what the knowledge is they ought to be pursuing. You don't even have to try. It's an automatic thing for you, isn't it? How did that get to be automatic? That's what you want to ask. Because the same process that made that automatic is the same process that can make this automatic if you so choose. And that's what we want to talk about. How to scientifically help you actively pursue the knowledge that you claim leads you to this via your chain. That's point one. And then the second is, how are you going to put yourself into a culture that encourages you to actively pursue that knowledge? And now, to give the secret of this whole thing away, it's this. You will actively pursue knowledge of the places in which you identify. And you build habits based on that as well. The world does a better job of bringing the knowledge to people that might even be tangentially interested in it than Christianity does. You have to come here to get this, or to Mike, to hear Mike's thing. You don't. The world will bring it to you. And Christianity's starting to crack the code on this a little bit. We see them making use of social media. We see ourselves making use of social media. We see ourselves making use of ways to bring Christianity out of the church and into the home, out of the church and into your work, out of the church and into your life. Not in some offensive, proselytizing way to people that don't want it. But I'm talking about bringing the culture to you the same way that Facebook and Twitter and TV and movies bring that culture to you.
You maybe skipped a step in there as you're talking about knowledge. It does seem as though you're saying, you know, basically all information is, you know, qualified as knowledge. I think that the thing that I might see as a sub-step is, you know, what is true knowledge, or what is the, you know, skill or capability we have for epistemological knowledge, in the fact that, you know, obviously culture is going to, you know, suggest what type of knowledge is true, but it's completely provisional or, you know, subjective.
And this goes to your earlier point of, I think these are similar points and both very good ones of, philosophically, if you understand how we know things, how we know what we know, what knowledge is, and determining what knowledge is true and what isn't. Yes, all that. Have I skipped a step? Well, certainly. There are a million sub-steps in here. I'm trying to kind of do the wave top thing. But let's put that in here as saying true knowledge. So we want true knowledge, actively pursue true knowledge.
And the only reason I'm saying it's a sub-step is the fact that there has to be a tool for you to be able to evaluate what true knowledge is versus
right.
Cultural or subjective or...
Yeah, absolutely the case. Absolutely the case. So... most people in here have an affinity for that already, so the fact that most people know what epistemology is when you say it, means that we're at least clued into the idea that we can know how we know things, or we need to think about how we know things in order to find out if the way that we're doing so is correct. But axiomatically, 3 weeks ago, we said, let us say that the kind of philosophy that we've been doing in here, philosophy and theology, is a way to discover true knowledge, and that science is a good way to discover true natural knowledge. So we basically waved our hands and said, let's assume that good philosophical thinking and good scientific thinking are our two best ways to lead us here, and that's why we're asking the question, how can we scientifically aid ourselves in this process? Because what we said is, to know things about the natural world, science is maybe the best tool that we found to do so. And you may remember we talked about, I don't remember if you're here, you might have been out for this one, where we talked about this body, the brain isn't your mind, and the brain has desires and tells you to do things that you can actually shape and change. You can change the structure of your brain in a way that helps you desire, or makes you desire one thing, or makes you desire another thing. We anecdotally and wrongly call it programming in some ways, but that's sort of what it's like. You're kind of, we might say we're programmed to believe that we ought to wear ties. We're programmed to believe that certain careers are more lofty than other careers. We're programmed to believe that knowledge is better than mysticism, as an example. Scientific knowledge is better than mysticism. So these kinds of things are not things that we came to just a priori on our own. They're things that I'm arguing, were brought to us, brought to our very doorstep by our culture and by our own education. And if I haven't made this point before, I'm sure I probably have here, but I repeat it for its own value. Everybody agrees that this is important, even in our culture, which is, in many ways, 180 degrees from this. But everybody agrees that this is the most important thing. And you've heard me do the chain of, why do we go to school? Why do we get an education? So we can succeed in life. What does it mean to succeed in life? So we can have a career and we can make money in order to be happy. Does making money make you happy? You lead them down the road, and the answer is no. Love is what we want in our life to make us happy. And yet, how many classes from K through 12 did you have in love? How many labs? How many practicums? How many courses of advanced study are there on love and the human being? Zero.
Zero.
Now, I think that's stupid. With a capital S and a capital tupid. It is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. Every human being on the planet, from guys that write fairy tales to guys that did the grant study at Harvard, can tell you that love's the most important thing to you, and you don't take a single class in it. I'm not a huge fan of our own education.
And even the God part, you go to school.
But ultimately, an educational system that claims to equip you for life and doesn't teach you what, even say a word about love. I've got to put it, you know who makes me more angry than our own educational system? This church. Not this church, the church. Because if when I ask for a definition of love in any given group of Christians, more than 90% of them will give you a blank stare and cannot define for you love. Can't do it. We can, you know, express and hand wave, but people are almost never right about that. They never put selflessness and benevolence together in the definition and make that core. And that's what it is. That's what it is at its truest level. So the fact that we are ignorant about that as the church means that we don't have a lot of credibility to look at the educational system and say, you guys have got it wrong either. Get it? Physician, you know, or take the log out of your own eye before you take the splinter out of the educational system.
How in the world are you going to teach love in school?
I'm glad you asked. Next week, we're going to go into that in detail. But the answer is, can it be done? If love is a real thing, if it's an actual regard that one human being, even if it's a complete, let's take a monist view, even if it's just the flesh, if there are scientific ways to find out how to make this hunk of material love this hunk of material in a way that this hunk of material understands it, and vice versa. And if that does seem, even if it's a complete illusion, even if it does seem to make us most happy, we ought to pursue that scientifically, no?
Yeah.
How can you possibly object to saying that love's a good
thing? I'm just trying to get my head around some fifth grader, the teacher is saying, okay, Dennis and Scott are in this room. I'm going to teach you how Dennis can love Scott. And right away, you're going to have 65 million protests against it. You're same sex.
Right, and we're love here, and this is part of the problem. When I say love to Western culture today, the 15 different images flash through people's minds, spanning from Victoria's Secret underwear models, romance, Valentine's Day, hearts, flowers, all this other stuff that actually has very little, if anything, to do with love. But we have replaced true love with those as ideas.
So you're talking about Scott's definition of love as opposed to...
No, I'm talking about if you ask any person, if I said to you, your definition of love, which do you think is more loving? Sex with somebody or figuring out what they need most and giving them that thing?
Well, the latter.
Okay, so I'm not talking my definition. I'm talking what everybody's definition always turns out to be. But what most people need, 99.9% of the time more, is an underwear, sexy underwear or lingerie. Somehow that's gotten, but 99% of the time, it doesn't fit that second definition. So if that's the case, why is Valentine's Day? Why are hearts and chocolates?
Culture.
Well, ladies, chocolate may be the thing that you need and want most. So I will back off the chocolate. All right, so if this is, ultimately, we recognize that we need to actively pursue knowledge. Let me talk about how to put you in the right spot. And this is really the major point for today is this. How do we position ourselves in such a way that we want to learn, that we want to desire what it is that we actually want to desire? In the scientific pursuit, biology, chemistry, physics, the answer is relatively simple. You put yourself in a chemistry, biology, or physics classroom. You go find somebody that knows about it, and you learn from them. We do it institutionally around here. Now you can do it at khanacademy.com. You can do it at stanfordhighschool.edu. You can go online and listen to physics lectures and quantum mechanics lectures by the greatest names in physics and quantum mechanics today for free. So the knowledge is actually out there for you to pursue literally at your fingertips if you want it. But you go and you put yourself in an environment. In this environment, it might be sitting in front of a computer and watching a lecture. It might be sitting down in a chair and opening a book. A quick aside, I saw somebody comment on one of these social media things. Ladies, there's guys that always come up and say, you know, can I buy you a drink? Why can't we replace that with a guy coming up at a bookstore to you and saying, I see, was it your post? Were you the one that put that one up? I see you're interested in this book. Let me buy you a book. Yeah, guys, take note. This would be much more effective.
From the love doctor.
I'm going to meet up on Facebook. So that's only a Zuckerberg is a love doctor. Okay. How do you put yourselves in the right situation? Let me tell you a secret. This is a secret that you probably know, but you may not have ever winnowed out.
Yeah, write this down.
And I have said it before in this class on the matrix kind of thing, but I'll break it out a little bit more. I'm going to use Mike's example from 2 weeks ago. Mike and I sat down and talked about this on the Tuesday after he gave this. You may have heard, by the way, we gave a class in here on the will at the same time he preached something on the will, and they were very opposite ideas. And so I actually sat down with him and said, I'm teaching something differently than you, or I want to ask you some questions about it. At the end of the conversation, of course, I think that Mike took our position. But
let's stop talking about
you. Great. Exactly. So the idea that Mike brought up was this. Was it Brand Muffins? Brand Muffins. He loved Brand Muffins. But Mike realized he was gaining weight. And he always went to La Madeleine, and he got a Brand Muffin. And every day, you know, I don't know how much those Brand Muffins are, but 400 calorie plus dose of Brand Muffin every day stacked up over time, especially when Mike's job doesn't let him PT a lot because he's always running around talking to people. Usually at Wegmans where the food's also good. So he has a difficult problem to beat when it comes to that. So what he said to himself was this. I'm going to change my desire. I now want to desire a healthier form of living than my desire for Brand Muffins leads me to. I want to reduce my desire for Brand Muffins, and I want to desire other healthier things. That's what Mike wanted to do. And what he said was, so then he got up and he went to La Madeleine and he was like, I'm not going to get a Brand Muffin. He stands in line and he's looking at the menu and he's like, I want to get these things. I'm not going to get a Brand Muffin. I'm not going to get a Brand Muffin. And he comes up to the cash register and they say, what do you want? He said, I'll have a Brand Muffin. So the idea was, he said, my will was insufficient to overcome my desire. And I said, Mike, when did you choose to have the Brand Muffin? I'll ask you this question. When did Mike choose to have that Brand Muffin? At what point in that chain did he actually choose it?
So as he went to the store.
I think when he chose to go to the store.
He said to himself, I'm going to go to La Madeleine and not. That is the equivalent of an, and Mike, you know, Mike's not an alcoholic. I'm not going to make that one. That's the equivalent of an alcoholic saying, I've got a problem with alcohol. I need to quit. I'm going to go to the bar. I'm just going to have a Coke. All right? We would laugh at an alcoholic who said, I've got a problem with alcohol, but I'm going to go to a bar and have a Coke. But when we will go to La Madeleine and we have a problem with bran muffin, what's the right way to choose not to have a bran muffin? Go to somewhere that doesn't serve bran muffins. Okay, eventually, when you're unhooked on bran muffins, can you go back in there? Eventually, when the alcoholic is so dried out and he understands it, can some of them walk back in the bars?
Sure.
Yeah.
Some of them.
Some of them. Not all. And that's the key thing, and that's part of the knowledge thing. Is this, there's a little bit of the know. I think we emphasize sometimes know thyself too much. But there is a know thyself thing. I have to do this too. There are situations that I have used to believe in my own hubris that my will was powerful enough to do anything. And it is. But I didn't realize I was making the choices by walking in there in the first place. Because of the limitations that I have. I have some strengths, and I'm very powerful in some areas, and I have some weaknesses, and I'm very weak in those areas. And it is avoidance of those areas that God has made me strong in some of them. But in some of them, it's still a struggle for me, and so I will not go into those places where other people can go without problems.
So all these secular examples that you're giving are fantastic, and they work because eventually we'll see the results.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
One more notch on my belt going inward instead of outward. On the immortality side, that's a lot of belief that you've got to have that when that time comes, you're going to make that cross. And that's where I think this falls apart.
So that's a good point. Because right now I'm really talking about the happiness on this side of the grave portion of it. So let me do that and defer. Do not forget that question. I beg you to bring it up again in either, not next week, but the following week, because that's when we'll answer that one in particular. Because really, most of what I'm geared towards right now is this on this side of the grave kind of thing. Okay, but a good point, and we do need to answer that. Now, I will tell you as a quick appetite whetter for that one. The more you live like this, the more you will see that the faith that you think that is required to do so seems to be an automatic. So the idea is, if you do this rightly, if this world really is God's world, by pursuing godly knowledge and seeing how this world works, the amount that we attribute to faith actually decreases to the point that it vanishes. And it does the same thing on the scientific side. The first time that you saw, every science teacher likes to show you something that looks almost like a magic trick when they do it, right? They light a balloon on fire and water comes out. How did that happen? When you're like, well, that's simple. It's just, this was hydrogen in here and a little bit of oxygen, and we lit it on fire, and hydrogen and oxygen, when they combine, make H2O, if you do them in the right proportions, and then water is the result. And everybody's like, oh, okay, that's not really a big deal. It's someone has said it eloquently, I can't remember, but any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. It might have been Eisenhower.
I think it is Asimov.
Okay. So the idea, though, is with knowledge, something that we would have thought, hey, Skylar, I want you to create a fire and produce water. All of us would be like, this is the shadiest magic possible. No magician is this powerful. But once we learn it in science class, we're like, meh. That's not exciting. And what I mean from a magic perspective, same thing. A major illusions when guys are, you know, bringing birds out in cages and they're turning them into women on stage, assistants on stage, and all that kind of stuff. We're like, wow, magic. And you find out how you're doing, you're like, that's lame. Knowledge removes the need for faith, because you don't need faith. If you knew God perfectly, trusting Him to do the right thing for you is like, of course He's going to do the right thing for me. Right now, it's hard for us to believe that. In this situation, does God really have my best interest in mind? Is He really going to do what I need in this case? That's a ridiculous question, isn't it? I mean, academically, it's ridiculous. It's not ridiculous in the moment. It seems like a legitimate question in the moment. But it's ridiculous when we think of it now. Because the need for faith decreases the better you know God. And the same reason that the better you know your significant other, if they actually love you as much as they do, your need for, when I say faith, I mean blind faith. I should be very specific. The blind faith that isn't evidence. The evidence means that kind of I'm hoping and trusting thing disappears entirely until I trust it to be basically a law. It's going to happen this way. It's not a problem. So more on that later, but I think that's the direction that it goes. Let me tell you when decisions are made. So this is the science that I promised you. I told some of this before, but not haven't cast it in this way. I was asked to join, this was a Georgetown Medical and University of Maryland study, and there's a whole section of psychology that talks about cognitive reappraisal. Cognitive reappraisal is where you look at a problem and you say, this problem is intractable, this problem is difficult, I don't know how to solve this problem. And instead of kind of getting stuck in this loop of I don't know what to do about it, you reappraise it in a certain way and you come up with the right answer. And what we're trying to really do is get over the automatic kind of fight or flight stuff. So what they were trying to do was do a high performance study, and they were trying to do it with military personnel, in my opinion, simply because military's got a lot of funding for this kind of thing, and they were chasing funding, as every good university does. The study was an fMRI study, and that what they did was they're going to show you, fMRI. So it's an MRI that they put you in, and they're going to show pictures. They don't shoot it in pure video. They do. They could run it together in video, but they're shooting a bunch of images that show
slices.
Yeah, not slices of the brain. Well, slices of the brain, yes, but they're doing it all at one time, and they're basically doing magnetic resonance imaging in order to say what are the active portions of the brain at the time. So if you you know, if you show somebody something and they're just taking it in visually, the back cortex of the brain is gonna light up, and so you're gonna see the lighting up of the brain in this fMRI machine. And so the procedure was you lay in this machine for an hour and you can't move at all, and you've got a joystick and a little, you know, eyepiece, and you got to move. They're gonna show you photos, and when they show you the photo, your brain's gonna react, and then they're gonna ask you how happy or sad you are based on seeing the photos. But ultimately, they're going to ask you to think about the photos in a different way, and then they're going to show you the photos again later, and they're going to ask you, how do you feel? And what they're looking for is an improvement, or a significant improvement over time, that this reappraisal works. So their goal, they used ROTC cadets as not low performers, but guys that had not been, were not all going to be the ultimate elite. And I was in charge of getting them like special forces troopers that were good troopers. What they don't know is I got them like the best special forces troopers you could ever imagine, because the best guys and a couple of gals are here in the Washington area. They've done a phenomenal job. They've kind of been brought into the mothership against their will at the Pentagon, and they are in charge of doing other bigger things. And so these guys were sitting around, and I asked them to participate in the study. So some like legends that these guys don't even know passed through that MRI machine and they got their brain moved. And then I did it too for fun, which I thought was interesting. So at first I had to coach them, because they showed, the pictures they were showing come from a standard deck of photos that I forget the name of the photos, but it's basically they use it all the way across psychology worldwide, because you don't need to know anything cultural to be able to react to these. Some of them are like a flower. Some of them are like a kitten, you know, the kind of stuff. And hopefully in no culture is a kitten like, oh, that's horrifying, I don't want to see it. And then a lot of the pictures were basically like gross bodily injury type of stuff. So they were showing some of these pictures, and they were like, yeah, these are the ones that are going to be very illicit, very negative stuff. I'm like, well, you're going to have a problem with the special operations guys. And they said, why? I'm like, well, go back to picture 14 or whatever it was. And they go back, and here's this guy completely bruised up, stitches running all the way down his side, all bloated and, I mean, distended and all this other kind of stuff. And I'm like, these guys are going to think that that's a good picture. And they're like, why? I'm like, this is a post-op picture. They've done surgery on him, they've closed him back up, they put this many stitches in him, and he's in the recovery room. That's where they've taken his picture. That's good news. That means he's going to live, and if they went to that much trouble, he's probably going to be all right. So no big deal. Another one is some lady with a horrible picture, her head's all blown apart. Like, these guys aren't going to react negatively to that, because they've seen it enough in either a medical environment or in war that they're going to see that one move right on. They're like, that's not even a person anymore. That's the remains of a body. Nobody, she's not home anymore. She's gone. So regardless of what their philosophical beliefs are, whether they're monists or whether they believe the spirit has fled the body, the bottom line is that nothing to do about that guy anymore. The ones that would was, there was one picture of a, I said, this one's going to be difficult too. Here's a kid running kind of at you in the picture, and there's a guy with a gun, and it almost looks like he's pointed at the kid. Now, he's not. He's actually pointed at something ahead of the kid. I'm like, there's none of these guys are going to think that's a problem, because they can do the parallax and realize that guy's not pointing his gun at the kid. There's some threat ahead of the kid. So that, again, not a problem for these guys. So we had to go through and select the pictures that would work better, that these guys would. You know what the pictures were that they reacted to most, to get the most visceral reaction on special operations guys? Hospital photos of women that were abuse photos, physical abuse. Here's the ones who've been beaten or whatever else. these guys would almost came out of the chamber when they would see it. You know, their brains would light up because they were like, I'm going to go find that guy. I'm going to break him. So it was interesting to see the differences in actions between these guys. But here's what it boiled down to. The in a very simple model, the back of the brain is what lights up when you see stuff and you're evaluating what you're seeing. And really what it's doing, in my opinion, this part's my opinion, is it's looking to match what it sees against prior things that have happened like that. So when you look up in your automobile window and you see red lights, the back of your brain lights up and it matches against what you know red lights are, which is a thing to stop. So you don't have to think about, oh, there's a red light. I wonder what the signaling system means. I think I've read about this somewhere. Perhaps it indicates that I should slow my speed. No, you're like, red means stop. So you're not having to, quote unquote, think about it. Not in the what we call the forebrain. So the forebrain is generally lights up more, generally, when you have to think about something, you're evaluating something. And this is where cognitive reappraisal goes on. This is where our cognition goes on. This is where what we call the thinking, what we mean is the conscious thinking, the thinking about thinking kind of stuff that we do, happens in the forebrain. So what we saw was this. ROTC cadets would see, you know, if here's kind of the brain longitudinally, you get some activity back here and some amount, and then you'd see these areas right here. There's two sides, two little zones on either side of the halves of the brain, the hemisphere of the brain. And then you'd see some, in the ROTC cadets, you'd see some movement around here. And it'd go from, you'd see some activation back here. Actually, it usually looked a little bit like this. And then you'd see this. And this would light up pretty big on each one of these photos. Special operations guys did not. What you saw was this region lit up like Christmas. And this one, you get a dot. What's happening, and this was a null result experiment. The cognitive reappraisal strategy did not work. And the cognitive reappraisal strategy did not work, in my belief, in my opinion, in my conclusion to this, which would require, of course, further scientific testing in order to bear out. You can't make a conclusion on a null result on a hypothesis you didn't test. But the hypothesis this suggests to me is these guys aren't having to think because they already have what you talked about, experience. They are so trained that when they walk into they run into a room, and there's one guy with a gun against somebody's head, there's another guy sitting on the floor in a blindfold and his hands cuffed, there's another guy standing there with the gun at the ready, and there's another guy there standing there with nothing in his hand. There's no thinking about what to do. Guy one gets shot, person two gets ignored, person three gets told not to move or might get shot, and person four gets ignored but put a guard on. It's automatic. It doesn't even happen. This is what happens. Observe, 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 match against what you know. This is, I haven't thought about this yet. And so they try to make decisions. You know how good their decisions were in the moment? How good are your decisions in a stressful moment when you haven't thought about it before? You always look back on it and you're like, man, I wish I could have done that a lot better. But that's the whole purpose of training. The whole purpose of training is so that you think about what to do and you learn about what to do before you have to do. This isn't science only. This is like, duh. Like, the military's known this forever. We know this forever. This is something that we do all the time through our own lives, but we don't utilize this. How does this turn into our struggles as Christians? This is what happens when you say, I'm going to Law Madeline, I'm not going to get a brand of it. When you have already decided for yourself that there is a situation that's going to come up, and I already know what the situation is, and I'll give you the example I give to the young men in the youth group. Gentlemen, if you are dating a girl and you feel very strongly about her and you're attracted to her, and she says, you go to drop her off at your home, I'm like, you have two rules that I would do in order that this becomes the case. One of those rules is when you put the car in park, you have 10 seconds to bail out. That's it. You got 10 seconds of sitting in the vehicle before you have to be out. And why? Because the longer you're sitting there, the more of this starts to happen and the less this starts to happen. And I said, the other thing is you don't cross her threshold if you're the only people in the house. Or will be the only people in the house later. And I said, I would put it up to you that maybe even crossing that threshold isn't a good idea ever until you're married. But what I say is, you make the decision, if you have drawn lines like that, wherever you make the decision to cross that boundary is where you chose to do that which you didn't want. Because they'll say things like, I didn't want to sleep with this girl, but I did. They chose to sleep with her when they cross the doorway. It's not a done deal at that point, but the choice was actually made earlier, and this is what's going on. All right? And so what I would say to you in the pursuit of what science can we bring to bear to say, how do you want to choose? And this is the first of maybe five major scientific principles I'll give you, and then we'll put it all together at the end of this, maybe another month before we're done. We'll finish in October. We will put this together into a plan for how to go forward. But the one that you want to know today is this. You make your choice on the hardest areas of your life several steps before you think you do. So think in your own mind what your current struggle is, whether it's a temptation, whether it's a lack of discipline for something, whether it's a, I want to love this person, but I keep getting into this environment with them, and it just, we end up arguing with each other, all that kind of stuff. You make the choice to do that before you get there. You make the choice to do that by even going to that place where, by going to the where. The human brain does things in the where that it doesn't do otherwise. And I imagine this. If anybody gone back to a high school reunion, gone back to your hometown or whatever else, if I told you, if I said, Dennis, remind me about this guy, you know, Timmy or Sally or Gal or Freddie, Dennis would come up with a few facts. When I take him and I put him back in the school, if it hasn't changed much at all these memories start hitting him, right? Nostalgia hits him. Memories hit him. He can tell you a bunch of other things that he couldn't have told you somewhere else. The where matters to the human brain. When you're trying to recall something, isn't a memory recollection technique? Put yourself mentally where it was that you were thinking about this, and oftentimes you come back up with the answer, right? We know that that's the case from our own experience. The first clue I want to give you as to how to change what your desires are is change where you are. It's that simple. This in the Bible is flee from the devil. Flee means leaving one place and going to another place. The idea being flee to a safer place, not to a worse place. But flee the devil, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. But flee temptation is the idea. Flee from temptation. Change the where you are. Changing your physical location can make you a better Christian. Point one. All right. So that was the lesson for today. And I would love for you all to think about it as to how it applies to your own life. In the end of October, we're going to write a plan for each one of you. So be thinking about this, and don't everybody avoid the last class in October, I beg you. But one of the other things that we'll come to in the next week or two are going to be, you need another person. So also think about who your accountability partner, that's the wrong term, because that's not actually what the person's going to do for you. They're not going to hold you accountable. That's not going to be their job. The question is, I'm going to turn it in terms of, who's your workout partner? Who's your lifting partner? So we'll get to that one in a few weeks. But ultimately, be thinking about who that person's going to be as well. And this week, think about where. As you travel through this week, think about the where you are and where temptation hits you, where difficulty hits you. And say to yourself, how could I change this in a way that is meaningful and worthwhile? Last question.
I want to go back to my original question. It sounds like you're trying to come up with ways not to want a Lamborghini, not to want a Lamborghini.
Yes, because what we said was Lamborghini won't do this. So when we broke it into things that we want to desire, we said desiring Lamborghinis doesn't lead to happiness and immortality. If it doesn't lead to happiness and immortality, then by definition it leads where? Unhappiness and death.
Whoa. Wanting a Lamborghini and having a Lamborghini necessarily leads to unhappiness?
Not necessarily, but if the Lamborghini doesn't control, this is the whole if statement. If this is what we want, and we agree this is what we want, and here's the if that you don't agree with. If this and this are the best ways to get it. If this and this are the best ways to get it. Then having a Lamborghini is no part of really of love or of Christianity, depending on whether the other person just really loves a Lamborghini. It's good.
A Christian can't want a Lamborghini?
They can want a Lamborghini. They can want a stripper. They can want an oak tree. They can want chalk. They can want to paint. They can want a chair. The question is, do any of those desires lead them in a time frame, in a limited time frame on earth, to this goal? And if the answer is no, why would you pursue something that doesn't give you your goal?
Why would a guy sitting in the car with his day, why does he have to get out of the car within 10 seconds?
Because there are chemical things happening in his brain that the longer he chooses to sit there,
the
less effective he is going to be at cognitively telling himself
as I fall over, and cognitively telling himself, I don't want to sleep with this girl anymore.
The idea being that a Christian would say, it's not going to make me happy to sleep with this girl before we're married. That's the assumption.
What if he just wants to sit there and talk to her?
How many guys have said that's what I'm going to do and end up
sleeping with this girl? You're acting like your girl doesn't have anything to do with this.
Right. There's a whole bunch of assumptions working in there. But there's enough laughter and nodding in here that if you have some difficulty understanding that, ask some of the people in this class and explain it to you. In their own, probably in their own stories. All right. So I'm out of time, and you know that the next class is coming in. But let me wrap up by saying this. We are taking a break from this next week. I apologize. I wouldn't have done this.